Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, how can I say this? How can I introduce this man to us? How? I don't have the words. I do not have the words. Because in my entire living life, I've never met such a great, sharp mind as our guest today. Yes, I'm talking about the famous, good-looking Casey Robert McBride, who's going to educate us all about Fred Costello. I hope I pronounced that man's name right. If I did not, I hope he forgives me. I don't know anywhere near as much I should know about this man. I'm sure that Mr. McBride will give us a great education. So with no further ado, let us all aim our guns up in the air and not try to kill each other as we surround our speakeasy as we welcome Mr. McBride to the show. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Wayne. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. So before we get into talking about Frank, let's hear a little bit about yourself and what you got interested in doing the crime stuff and Frank himself, sir.
Well, I kind of got into it. I had a drum teacher years ago who was kind of from the big band era, and he used to tell me all sorts of great stories about working in the clubs, you know, kind of from that golden era of American history, and all those clubs were pretty mobbed up, so he had great stories about, you know, guys that ran the clubs and also the guys that ran the music union, which, you know, you had to go through back in those days, especially to play. So it kind of got me interested in it because, you know, the stories were so fascinating. But after that, I kind of got into The Sopranos, like a lot of people, I think, that are into this stuff. And it kind of forced me to learn a little bit more about the real story of the stuff. And I got the book Five Families from Cell and Rap, which, you know, most people in this biz really love. And from there, it was just, you know, it took off. And if you're going to, like, study, I think, a little bit about the history of the real mob, you know, it doesn't take long before Frank Costello's name comes up. He's involved in so many different areas and stuff. So I got just real fascinated by the guy. He's quite a character.
Oh, quite the character. And you said so much because it was, in many ways, a golden age. And I think what's interesting at the same time is we choose to use media to glorify the good points of things, right?
We
ignore so much. And at the same time, now we're getting to the point where we're going to start ignoring our past. I think it's important that you, like people like yourself and others, do what they do to make sure we don't forget about our past and remember it correctly versus what the media would like us to believe.
I agree, actually. You know, it's funny, after kind of learning more about Frank Costello, and he's known, you know, kind of widely for being a guy who had a lot of political influence and things like that. And it really opened my eyes to a lot of stuff just in, you know, everyday life. You know, I feel like in school they should probably have a section when you're in high school on, you know, organized crime and what it does, the effect that it's actually had on our political system and stuff, because it certainly did, you know, probably more so back then than it does now, but you never know.
Don't be sure. You don't be too sure, and we'll talk, and we'll get there, I'm sure. But one thing that fascinates me is I'm active in the legalization of cannabis from personal, medical, other uses, right? In doing so, I started to educate myself on the role of the Mexican drug cartels.
Right.
And the huge difference between how they do things and how the mafia did things and does things, because as you read about Mexican cartels, they'll kill people without two thoughts. But it seems, especially with Frank, the last thing they want to do is kill anyone.
That, you know, that tends to be the story. It's hard to say, not being there and actually, you know, not knowing the man personally or anything. But, you know, his myth or his legend tends to be kind of that, as the guy that threw away the gun and used his brain more. But he certainly, you know, having murder ink and a mob behind you, you know, a lot of times that's probably a deterrent where you don't need a gun. If everybody knows that those are your friends, they'll probably be a little bit more willing to go along with you.
People aren't going to do anything stupid. I mean, when I say the Mexican cartels, I was reading more information about that bus that was stabbed in northern Mexico, going from one city to another city. They pissed off the wrong mayor, and he had all of them killed. Something the mob would have never tolerated.
They mean business down there. That's a whole other section. I mean, you know, that's I heard your show with Dave Amoruso, and you know, he's one of those guys, he knows a lot about that. So it's, I don't really read up too much on the cartels and stuff, so it's interesting for me to be able to hear somebody who has kind of an education on that and kind of know what they're doing.
Well, absolutely. I only have respect for all the people out there doing research and talking about the organized crime, because it is such a huge subject. Now, what fascinates me, I think, the most is I have a thing about two boxes in slot machines. And I understand that Frank was big on that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was kind of the king on the king of the slots, really. And one of the great things about Costello, I think, that sets him apart from some guys is he's kind of one of those businessmen that seem to be able to know what's going to be popular before everybody else. And a lot of the people that worked with him, you know, claimed that when he was in bootlegging, pretty much about halfway through the whole Prohibition era, he knew it was going to disappear eventually, or he was going to get muscled out by somebody else, you know, for what he had. And so, you know, they all said he'd already turned his sights to slot machines. So by the time, you know, one thing got popular that he was doing, he was already onto something else. And he really recognized, I think, you know, the business opportunities that you could have with slots. And it's one of those businesses, too, that I think it's kind of tolerable to the public, you know, even in places where it's illegal. Like you and Larry Henry were talking on the last show, you know, it's all things that people will allow to happen. As long as nobody's getting hurt, if people want to go put a couple coins in the slot machine, let them do it, you know. People let it roll. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, as I speak to you this morning, sir, this afternoon now, within two blocks of my home, there is a gas station with three video machines going, and they started again at 7 this morning. They run tonight till the station closes around 11 o'clock this evening. None of the seats will grow cold from nobody sitting in them, and people will be pumping quarter after quarter, dollar after dollar in them.
It's, you know, it's amazing. A lot of money goes in and out of those machines. I don't have the exact figures. It kind of depends on what you read. But, you know, back in the 30s when Costello was putting those in, you know, kind of the same thing. Every candy store, every bar, you know, in New York and in that area, he was making millions of dollars, you know, in the 30s, in the Depression. So, and a lot of that money didn't go to him. You know, there were payoffs and bribes and all. Everybody's got to get their cut. But still, I mean, it's just a – that's a lot of money today, and back then, you know, it's unimaginable to me. But once he got shut down by LaGuardia there too, and when it seems like they'll have a tolerance till you get one political figure that kind of wants to make that his mission, and they'll clean the city up a little bit. But he just took it down to New Orleans, and you know, they welcomed him down there, so he just took every slot machine he had in storage up in New York and put it in Louisiana, and it was business as usual again. So. He kept that thing rolling for quite a few years.
Right, which fascinating, too, is he climbed in bed with one of the biggest thieves ever, you know, Huey Long.
Oh, yeah. He's, in fact, I just got a great story from a guy that was a great friend of Frank Costello, and he was sort of his liaison, with Huey Long and the organized crime family down in New Orleans, and this guy named Diamond Jim Moran. And, his grandsons have been kind of working with me. We're hopefully going to have a book out coming pretty soon, but they've been, you know, giving me great stories that their father has told them, and he was very close with a lot of those guys. And apparently the first time that Frank met with Huey Long to kind of organize this slot machine deal, they met in Louisiana, and Diamond Jim had a hunting lodge that was on Lake Pontchartrain, and Frank would be able to fly in on a pontoon plane, and they could take him to the hunting lodge by boat, so nobody would even know he was down there, and they could meet with these people. And the very first meeting that they had with Long, apparently he got pretty drunk on wine and passed out towards the end of the meeting. And Frank was pretty miffed about it, and Diamond Jim took him outside. They were walking along the river. He was kind of calming Frank down, you know, saying, "Now, you know, don't worry, he's just not used to drinking this kind of Italian wine that we're drinking." And Frank was like, "I've never had this happen to me before at a meeting." So, they, you know, by that time, the agreement was pretty much made. They knew that it was going to go through. And they ended up meeting in New York a few weeks later and kind of sealed the deal. And after that, you know, Frank brought him down and let the good times roll.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good time. I mean, again, at least I'm no expert in Louisiana and this the organized crime and the political corruption. I do know a little, but you know, people criticize Louisiana for a lot of things. But again, you don't have the killings. Well, actually, in New Orleans, you did. It's kind of a weird city. You know, once the mob got rolling, it seems the mob is somewhat interested in making sure that your person going to the candy store, the bar, or the casino knows they can go and have a nice time, and on the way out, that can be robbed, killed, or maimed.
Yeah, you know, exactly. That was a big thing with Frank Costello. You know, like when he was an older man, he lived on Central Park there, and you know, he didn't want to walk through the park at night because he was afraid to get mugged. He was Frank Costello.
Yeah.
You know, these guys, I think, you know, guys like Frank that are kind of more political figures than really tough guys. I always call them, they're more savvy than psycho. And they're kind of two separate forms of guys in the mobs. You got, you know, the guys that are tough that just scare the bejeebus out of somebody to get what they want. And you got guys that kind of, you know, do it more in a political fashion. And those kind of guys, like Frank, you know, they want to live in a good community. They don't want to live in a town where crime and people getting shot all over the place. You know, they have to live there too. So, you know, if they can keep things quiet and peaceful, why not? Better for everybody.
Right. Better for everybody. I mean, again, you know, if your bar doesn't have a crowd because nobody feels safe going to it, you can have every form of entertainment known to man, and nobody's going to walk in that door. But people feel safe, you know, knowing if, even if they leave, they know that that can get robbed on the way to the car because they may have hit some number somehow, right? You know, the most
exactly,
likely they're going to
yeah.
come bring their friends. You know, that's the thing. Now, and you said to yourself, later in life, he didn't want to walk around Central Park because he was worried about being mugged or hurt somehow. Could you talk to us a little bit, another incident happened before he kind of retired, about when he was almost assassinated?
Well, I mean, basically, you know, he'd been, it's debatable who you talk to, whether or not he was truly the boss of what that crime was, would be the Luciano family. He did that for a few years. After Lucky was put in prison, Vito Genovese kind of took over for about a year, and then he was up on a murder charge, so he basically had to flee the country. And the family was basically given to Frank to run. It really wasn't, I don't think, something that he was looking to do, but, you know, it fell upon him, and he took the job, and he did it, and he was good at it. He was a good organizer. He was good at leading people that way. But there were... there was a faction when Vito Genovese returned, you know, he wanted his family back. I think he felt, you know, it was rightfully his. And it took him years, but he basically kind of turned the tide, I think, from a lot of the lower echelon guys in the family against Frank. Frank was up there at the top making a lot of money for other people at the top, but some of the guys down at the lower level didn't do as well. And I think one of the reasons that is because for making money for Frank was easy. He's one of those guys, to him it was a talent, so I don't think he saw it as a chore, and he just kind of figured, why can't everybody do this? It seems so simple. But it's not that easy for a lot of other people. And he let a lot of the people underneath him do their thing. He didn't rule them with like some iron hand and tell them all what to do. He was like, you know, go do your thing, make your money, and everybody be happy. But it wasn't that easy for a lot of those guys, and they didn't do as well. And so Vito was able to really turn the tide sort of against Costello in those later years. They had a nickname for him. It was kind of a slag. They called him his Gray Eminence, which was kind of like the guys used to call Paul Castellano the Pope, because they, you know, they never saw him. When they did, it was just a rich dude in a suit in some flashy place. He wasn't down there really with like the guys at the lower level very often. So Vito decided to basically make a move and take the family back. And he got the Chin Galante, Vincent Chin, to basically try to take Frank out. And he was walking into the lobby of the Majestic apartments or penthouses there on Central Park West where he lived, and walked into the lobby, and the Chin walked in behind him, said, "This is for you, Frank." And Frank turned around and he pulled the trigger. And luckily, you know, for Frank, the bullet just grazed his head. But the Chin thought he was dead, ran out, took off wherever he was going to go. And then they found out, you know, a few hours later that, you know, Frank was still alive. So I'm sure that sent a lot of shockwaves through the family.
Yeah.
They, you know, they thought he was gone, and they found out he's not dead. You can just imagine what was going on then. But you know, Frank was I think he knew he was outgunned. His time was over, and he basically just stepped down. He wasn't going to go to war. I don't think he had the power to do it at that point anyway. And he knew, you know, his time was done, and he was lucky to be alive. So he stepped down and basically lived the rest of his life as a rich dude. I mean, his life didn't change much. A lot of these guys you see, once they're out of the life or whatever, you know, their lifestyle really goes down because they don't have the money. But Frank had piled away a lot of cash. And he was, you know, he still had some legitimate business interests that were making him money. So, you know, for him, in a way, it was kind of a win-win. I think his ego was bruised, but he was rich, he was alive, and he could still, you know, basically do what he wanted. He was off the police radar then, too. So I think a lot of those hassles were gone. So for him, it was probably kind of a blessing in disguise, I think, later on. And, you know, he continued to be kind of an advisor to numerous guys in the families and stuff. Guys from other families would come and meet him at the Waldorf to talk to him and get advice. And he was known for one of those guys, you know, who was good at that. He was a smart dude, so people still came to him for years and years afterwards. And I think that miffed a lot of bosses sometimes. People were still going to, you know, talk to him for advice instead of coming to them. But that's kind of my favorite period of his life, I think, was actually once he retired and was just, you know, an old dude out doing his gardening and going to the Copa at night and hanging out, but he still was kind of had one foot in there still. It was interesting.
Absolutely. What I think is fascinating, too, is so Frank is wounded, right? He gets hold of the hospital. In the center of his packets, they find a piece of paper. Can you talk about that piece of paper they found and what led to people believing?
Yeah, it was. At that time, Frank had, he was kind of a silent owner, the man behind the Tropicana. And he basically, that day, he had met with a guy earlier and gotten the receipts for that month, the take at the Tropicana. And when he got shot and he was at the police station, one of the officers went in his coat and got the piece of paper. I don't know. I don't think it was actually legal. I'm not sure how that works, but they got the piece of paper and they noticed that the numbers matched exactly with the receipts and all the money they brought in from the Tropicana. So it caused a lot of problems. It really connected him to that. And he was asked about it in court. He refused to say anything about it. He got contempt and got a couple months in prison again.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, he was not afraid to take the fifth, which I think is interesting. And I think that's too, going back to that note, was it also, I don't have my notes in front of me, but that piece of paper also led the powers that be to understand those were more political shenanigans going on in Nevada than they knew about, because the people that were involved and that piece of paper.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say where, you know, how many like casinos or whatever that he even had a piece of. Pretty much anything that Lansky was involved in, usually Frank would be involved in too. Those guys were pretty tight, and they trusted each other. They knew each other were good at business, and they would, you know, they would bring each other along when one had a deal. Frank had lots of things in New Orleans that he brought Lansky in, and Lansky, I think, brought him in with things in Florida. But, you know, who knows what they were involved in, especially in those days. It was so much easier to kind of move around underneath the radar.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't really do that these days.
You know, it's harder to do. I think it's interesting, as you bring up something, too, is how he got along so well with his friends in the past, because they would make money together and didn't have to kill people to do it.
Yeah, you know, he was a good guy to do business with. I mean, one of the reasons he had the job that he got when I think Luciano put him in charge is he knew Frank was a good guy to basically be the go-between the mob and the legitimate world. You know,
right.
Frank could go to dinner with a politician and his wife and go out to the Copa and be entertaining and charming and nice and not be scary and freak people out, you
right.
know. So
right.
guys, they can't do that. It's just not in their nature. They're intimidating people. That's what they do. That's what they like to do. And you can't do that when you're going out with, you know, a CEO and or a politician. And then in those days, you know, it was kind of the last time that you could do that. And that was one of the things that I find interesting about it, too. Like, you know, in Frank's time, he was one of the last of the big shots, could go out to dinner with a politician in public at the Waldorf. You know,
right.
if somebody did that today, it'd be all over the place. You know, it'd be scandal.
Well, it all depends how it was reported.
He kind of did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody would have it on their cell phone, you know, it'd be on YouTube. But he could kind of get away with that, you know.
Yes. But, I mean, Frankenstein, I mean, to use your saying, Uncle Frank, everybody knew of Uncle Frank because I'm sure people didn't like him. I'm sure that he didn't do everything above board. Obviously, he was a gangster, right? But since more or less innocent people weren't hurt, they could buy into the idea, the myth, if I may say so, that, oh, hey, there's Frank, you know. Hey, look at him. He's eating the special tonight. Maybe I'll try it the next time I show up. Oh, is this the club he goes to? Let's go here next time, dear. Maybe we might see him. Maybe we might see somebody else, right? I think that's interesting to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, those were days, you know, being seen with the mobster, or, and that kind of still is today, I guess, in some ways. But, you know, back then that was kind of a thing, you know, with like Walter Winchell and all those guys. And, you know, the people went to those clubs, and, you know, Bugsy Siegel would be there, Frank Costello would be there, but, you know, also, you know, politicians, judges, all that kind of stuff. And people, you know, he didn't hide, like, a lot of, you guys have to do that nowadays. But in his day, you know, his social club that he hid out in or whatever was the Waldorf Astoria. You know, he was wide out in the open at, like, one of the richest places in town. And every day he'll get a haircut and a shave in the barbershop, and anybody who wanted to talk to him or wanted to get a hold of him knew, if you wanted to get a hold of Frank, you go to the barbershop, and guys down there will put you in touch with him if it's something that's important. So it wasn't hard to get to him, you know.
No, it wasn't, and he was available. And it's so much different today because, one, the whole concept of what a mob family is, I think, radically different than it was and then. And second, you're correct again, is that it doesn't have the same reputation, and therefore it doesn't have the glamour, right? I mean, I have no interest in meeting anybody who's really truly in the mob, right? I've enjoyed having the honor of meeting some people that were involved in organized crime, who've changed their lives around, right? That's always good because I can learn from that. God knows I've had to change my life around from the days I was a hardcore raging alcoholic, right? And it gives me strength to know that if you get somebody who's involved doing bad things for years, if they can change your life around, and the only struggle I have is how to deal with my train contractors, dealing with my roof, I got it pretty fucking lucky.
Right. Yeah. You know, he's the kind of guy, kind of like you're saying, like, I'm not that interested really in the killer side of it either. Yeah. You know, I've always said, I would probably sit down and have a drink with Frank Costello. I wouldn't sit down and have a drink with, you know, Mad Sam or somebody like that, or Roy DeMeo. I'd be terrified of guys like that. But he was a little different than that. And he was, you know, one of the things he did that kind of also, I think, did him in, it caused a lot of problems for him later, is when he had semi-legitimate businesses, like all these casinos and restaurants and things, he hired his family. He tried to put his family to work in legitimate jobs. He was dead set against anybody that he was related to getting involved in any of this thing. But he would put them to work in, you know, sort of legitimate as they could be kind of jobs. And he didn't really give those to the guys in the mob. And I think a lot of those people basically felt like, well, hey, you're supposed to be, you know, throwing this stuff down to us. Like, we're your family. And he didn't really see it that way. Like I said, he let those guys do their thing. Like, you guys are on your own. Make your money. As long as you don't kill anybody or get arrested or whatever, and I don't have to hear about it, fine, do your thing. But
I
think he thought he was being a good boss by doing that, and a lot of people didn't see it that way. They felt more like he should be handing that money down to them, not his people. And he saw it different, but I kind of like that about him. I think that is kind of a cool side of his character.
I concur. I think it's interesting to say the least. I mean, we can learn a lot from people like Frank. We can. Same thing with Marlansky, right, and other people. We can learn a lot from their lives. I think And I don't have it. I don't have it because I was going to pitch you a book title. I must have lent it. Of course, meaning if I leave my books, I usually do not make it back. But it was an interesting book about how Sony looked at the early crime figures of the 30s and came up with a book on business idea. Not business ideas, but how to conduct business, right?
Right, yeah.
They were. You know, how you make money when everybody's out to get you. How do you make money? How do you handle yourself in difficult situations? You know, and
right.
Again, before I start to claim that Frank was an angel sent from heaven above, he was also capable of taking care of the other side of the business deals if he had to, correct?
Yeah, you know that's one of the myths. I think there are many. His legend is pretty huge. He lived a long time. He lived through a lot of, like, all the major eras, and he was involved in so many different things, like Vegas and New Orleans and New York.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many myths about the guy, and as time goes by, you know, they get bigger and they get bigger. And the story that people like to write about, you know, it's Frank. He's the nice guy. He's the guy who threw away the gun that just wanted to make some money and have everybody be happy. But how nice can you really be to get to that position? You know, I always say, people say Vito Genovese wasn't very smart. And I'm like, well, he must have been pretty smart. You don't get to the top of the New York crime family without being smart. And it's the same thing
right.
with Frank Costello. You know, they say he wasn't tough. Well, he might not be tough compared to Roy DeMeo, but he's pretty tough compared to, you know, probably the average Joe. He grew up in, you know, amazing situation with nothing but tough guys all around him. He had to be, you know, a fairly tough dude just to get where he did. And he, you know, I don't believe he ever whacked anybody himself. There's debate whether he did or not, but I've never seen any proof. Most of the things I've read and heard from other people, I don't think he ever did. But, you know, he certainly, you know, gave the order many times. It was more of like
yes.
a general or as like an admiral or something like that. You know, he would have
right,
had to.
Right.
And he had murdering
right.
at his disposal. So, you know, he had guys to do that for him. He didn't need to do it himself.
No, he didn't have to do it himself. Well, why get your hands dirty when you have someone who can do it for you? Now,
right.
if I understand correctly, and please correct me if I'm mistaken, he had to be one of the people who gave the order to have Bugsy killed, correct?
He had to have known. Yeah, you know, I mean, I would imagine he had to have something to do with that. He was kind of on the hot seat himself at that point because, you know, he was one of the guys who basically backed Bugsy on that and got a lot of people
right.
to put money in for him. And it, a lot of them did it, I think, you know, because Frank and Meyer were like, you know, this is a good investment probably, so people went along with it. And, you know, he was having some problems with some other guys himself because of that. You know, they're like, where's our money? What's going on with this? But, you know, I think he would have had to known. I don't think it was something that he wanted to do, but, you know, certainly he had to be involved in it at some point. And, you know, Christian Cipollini has a really interesting kind of theory about how, you know, Frank Costello was probably one of the main architects of Murder, Inc. And one of the reasons that would be is him being a guy that wasn't going to go out there and get his hands dirty himself. He was going to need some kind of division to take care of that
yeah,
for him.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
and him being the organizer he was and the way he worked, you know, he ran things really much like a business. And so,
right.
you know, there's kind of a theory that that's probably might have been his idea. You know, we need this group of guys here that we need them to go do something, they'll go do it. And they're organized and they work in a, you know, a systematic way. And I tend to agree with that. That sounds like a Frank Costello thing to me right there. You know, there was nothing just haphazard about the way he did stuff. You know, he was very calculated in his movements. And
right.
I tend to agree with.
Yeah. I mean, right. I mean, if you're going to have a business empire, you need an arm to enforce policy, be it the idea that, you know, Joel got caught stealing out of the till, again, we need to do something. You know, when I worked at Sears, you fired them, right? If you caught stealing out of the casino, you might lose your job if you were lucky, but more than likely, depending on how much money you got caught stealing, et cetera, you would probably end up someplace in the desert.
Yeah, you know, again, like Egg was saying, he was a gangster at the end of the day. I think one of the things that's interesting about him most to me is I do think he kind of lived to regret a lot of that stuff. He lived long enough, you know, to be kind of an old man where his life had an arc where he started off as a real tough kid, you know, mugging people. Had he continued on that course, he probably would have killed somebody. But luckily, you know, he found out he had this head for business and he went a different direction. But it's still, you know, later on in life, I think he felt like he wished he would have done something else. And I think he was one of the few that could have made it.
Yes,
and
I agree.
You know, had the government just left him and Lansky alone and said, like, hey, we're going to legalize gambling. We're going to put you two in charge. You know, like,
yes.
Here, now you got your permits. Like, go do this right and we'll regulate it. You know, he would have been excellent at that. And he was actually approached by the government of Turkey, I think it was Yugoslavia or Turkey, when in his retirement. They wanted to start a Vegas-style town over there, and they came to him. They were like, we want you to run this. Like, we want you to be the dude. And he turned him down. He turned him down, like, flat. And he said because he couldn't trust working with the government. And I think the real reason was that he, you know, he made a deal with Genovese that if he retired, he'd stay out of all the business and stuff. And I think that was probably the real reason he turned it down. He would have got too much money, too powerful doing something like that, and I think they would have come back after him, and he knew that. So he let it go. He would have been good at it, though.
He would have been damn good at it. I remember reading, and I'm so bad with names, you have to forgive me, a man they referred to as Mr. Lucky, who was an early investor in Vegas, and he got the gig is running gambling in Mexico, and they try to kill him for it.
Yeah.
I mean, again, the same thing. I mean, the mob protects their business interests, you know, and they will protect them by shooting people if they have to.
Definitely, yeah. Or worse.
Yeah.
You know,
or worse. Absolutely.
Who knows? But, I mean, it's kind of like we were saying, it's an interesting thing to read about. It's a fascinating part of American history, but it's definitely not one of the things that me personally, I could never be involved in something like that. For a guy like Costello, just the nerve that you would have to have just to live every day. Not only do you have guys coming after you with guns that want to take your power, but you got the government coming after you, you got the law coming after you. There's never a time when you could just sit back and relax. You know, it's you'd have to have nerve as a steel to live that life, and definitely not something I'd be able to do.
No, you have to have bigger balls than I have to do it consistently, day in, day out. I mean, I'm just thankful that I didn't go down that. I mean, not that I would have, but you know what I'm saying. I didn't have to make those choices that many people had to back in the days of the Depression. What are you going to do to feed your family? You know, here we're seeing it's bad enough because we got many. I'm not judging the whole population when I say that. I know that there's some people out there slinging hash or cocaine or whatever they're selling around here these days, you know, because the only choice they have to feed their family is to sell drugs. I mean, you know, what would you do in order to make sure your family was fed versus starve? I think people would be motivated to do quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, until you're in that situation, it's really hard to say. It's, you know, it's tough. And, you know, they lived in some pretty rough situations back in the day. Like, you know, Frank came with that kind of wave of Italian immigrants at the turn of the century there, where, you know, in East Harlem, it was a rough life. It was not easy.
Yeah.
And he didn't speak the language, you know. It came over from a foreign place. His dad was almost 50 when he came over here. You know, he had I had four daughters and two sons, and I'm almost 50 myself right now, and I'm trying to imagine just packing up my family and moving to some country right now where I didn't know the language, I didn't know anybody. I don't think I could do it. It'd be tough.
I can't imagine. I mean, I live a nice home in Racine, Wisconsin, in the slum, right? I'm privileged, right? And in many, many ways, I'm very, very thankful for it. And I can't imagine living in a tenement apartment with one bathroom for the entire floor. If you're lucky, it might work 2 or 3 days out of the week.
Yep.
You know, sewers said, don't run well. You got no indoor plumbing to speak of, et cetera, et cetera. Right? But these people didn't, I'll give them a lot of points. They didn't fold up and say, oh, well, it was me. Let me lay here and die, or worse, I expect someone else to take care of me, right? And yes, they stole,
right.
Yes, they robbed, yes, they did these other things. But they also figured out early in life, and correct me if I'm wrong, that people will pay good money to get do what they want to do. So when Prohibition came about and they figured out that, yeah, people want to still drink, let's get them the booze they want to drink, boom, they can make money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, Frank started off, you know, pretty young, doing crap games and doing all that kind of stuff in the street, you know, the kids do. And that's how he met, like, Lupo the Wolf and Cerro Terranova were the guys in those days. And they saw him and recognized his talent. And apparently he was very good at doing math in his head. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
for a young kid back then, you know, that was probably pretty unusual. And he was real reliable, too. So they put him to work. And, you know, he was making more money than his dad, you know, when he was just a kid. So it's hard to tell, you know. Tell it, stop doing that. Like, why don't you go to school? Why don't you do this? Like, well, why do I need to go to school when I'm making money doing this?
Oh,
and, you know,
yeah.
It was probably fun for him back then, you know, being a young kid. They like to get in trouble and do all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, that's basically how he got started. And, I probably about 98% of most of the big names from that era got started. The story is almost all the same. It's pretty interesting.
Pretty much. You know, they look for an area that they can excel in. It's any immigrant group. If they look for an area that they can excel in, they don't have to compete with other people. You know, they can sit there in this niche market, shall I say, doing these niche jobs and do well for themselves and their families. You know,
right,
you
yeah.
And it goes without saying. I mean, be it Prohibition, and then he's smart enough to see the right end of the wall, right, and think of, Prohibition's going to end tomorrow. What else that people want to do? Well, slot machines.
Right.
Yeah, jukeboxes. I mean, you know, it's huge, but, you know, because people want music when they drink. Jukeboxes work. We'll just put jukeboxes out there. And, yes,
right.
It'd be a good idea to get my jukeboxes versus someone else's jukeboxes, by the way, but, yeah. You know, it's fascinating.
Yeah, you know, the whole vending machine, you know, I always think of a vending machine as like a jukebox or a candy machine or something,
yep.
But it's, you know, when you're Frank Costello, it also includes slot machines and things like that. And, you know, he had a lot of them. He had tons.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Wayne.
I'm sorry. No, I didn't mean to cut you off. I apologize.
One of the things that he did to get around it was he named one of his companies the True Mint Company. And his slot machines would basically give out a mint. And then sometimes if you won, it would also give out, you know, like a nickel or whatever that you could pick up and you could get money from the counter, or it would,
okay.
You know, dispense the money itself. But that's how he got around a lot of stuff. He said they're candy machines. And
yeah.
He even had little stairs made so that little kids could get up and put, you know,
yeah.
a money, put a dime in there too. So he was equal opportunity. He didn't want to discriminate against children, you know. If they're going to put some money in there,
yeah.
He was going to get that too.
Well, why not? I mean, to me, I'm fascinated by vending machines of all types because, to me, it's they have their issues, but mostly it's a pure service industry of entertainment. You know, there's low overhead, high rate of return. Their ROI is incredible great, right? All you have to do is find the spots with traffic where people come there and play them. I mean, how many times have we seen kids at restaurants do different games like that? There's a crane machine that's trampled up here, where you put 50 cents, you get 2 minutes to pick up a toy with a crane.
Exactly, yeah. You know,
yeah.
Training them early is what that is.
Yeah, I mean, and nobody gets a toy after the first 50 cents. And of course, they go back to mom and dad.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to play again. You know, or the quarter for a small piece of bubble gum, and it rolls down this little thing that Johnny and Jill can watch roll down. And maybe, you know,
right.
There's a little cup of a toy or something. I mean, people like that sort of thing, right? And why not have that? Why not have the, what's the word I'm looking for here? The market for that, right? Because why not?
Yeah, exactly.
Because people want to play it. People want to do those things. As of
yeah,
now,
you know what?
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I keep cutting you off. I do apologize.
It's these damn cell phones. It makes it hard to hear. But, Yeah, I mean, one of the, you know, what Costello's whole thing was, I think it's the same thing that, you know, with Lansky, too. If we're going to do it, let's do it right. And they made classy, cool joints, you know.
Yeah.
Like Frank had the Beverly down in New Orleans, and, you know, they had the top entertainment, great food, and gambling, you know. He owned the Copa. He was, you know, very good at doing that. I don't know that they really had gambling there. They probably did in the back room or, you know, it's secret. But he was good at making clubs and restaurants and nice places, classy places where people wanted to go. And,
yes.
You know, if you, why not do it right? And like I was saying, that's what the government probably should have done back in the day. It was just give, let those guys run their thing and take a cut of it, and everybody could have been happy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, who knows what the government might do now? I mean, I know it's funny, speaking of the government and gambling and the like, I mean, at Galanoi is so broke they were unable to pay their Mega Bucks winners, right? So they almost had to give it up. They couldn't almost got to the point where they could not be allowed to sell those gambling tickets anymore because they had no money to pay the customers. But I bet you money that if you walked into any of Frank's own businesses and you hit the jackpots, the jackpot, you got paid.
You got paid. I would hope so.
Yep, and you got to your car okay. If you wanted to go to a bank, they made sure you got there because that's how you get more people coming back.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of goes back to like we were saying. You know, nobody's going to want to live in an area or, you know, do business with somebody that is, you know, it's constantly going to be ripping you off. You know, and so people will have a tolerance for that for only so long. You know, the same thing with the violence. Like, I, you know, that's one of the things that the mob was good at understanding is people will put up with so much. And then once it crosses that line, then you're in trouble. So you have to maintain a balance. And you know, he was good at that.
Absolutely, and that's important that people quickly forget. As people want at the end of the day, what you promise them. If you're playing a jukebox, you know they want your music. All right, let's set something aside. Interesting too about the jukebox situation is. Many people, Barbara Streisand was after Frank stepped down, but many people became famous as singers because they got plays from jukeboxes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, that was it's just like radio or MTV,
yeah.
You know, a medium of the day. That's where people are getting the music and hearing that. He was actually pretty responsible for getting a lot of people started in their careers.
Yes.
You know, because he owned the clubs, you know, like I said, this is kind of how I got interested in this stuff was, you know, through a musician who worked in these clubs. But, you know, that's where those entertainers went. They went to the Beverly and they went to the Copa. And to get into those places, you had to go through Frank. He was the guy, you know. And he was very adamant. He wanted the best entertainment. He didn't want anything substandard. And so he's kind of like a talent scout in a way. He actually even during the Kefauver committee, they're asking about, you know, some of his money that he makes for these clubs. And he's like, well, I get it for being basically a talent scout. I recommend talent. So
I mean, that makes
that was
sense.
One of the
I mean,
ways he disguised his money.
Yeah, it only makes money. It only makes sense. You know, and again, going back to my good friend Bugsy couldn't do the Screen Actors Guild, but he had the Screen Extras Guild for a while that made him a small fortune.
Right.
You know? I mean,
yeah,
his money.
Frank had a hand in that. You know, I don't think a lot of people know that in Los Angeles, you know, Frank had a pretty big influence out there too. It was ridiculous the influence he had. Like, I mean, Florida, L.A., Hot Springs, New Orleans, New York, Canada. He was everywhere. There's not you know that many bosses that really had an influence as big as he did. And so not only did he live a long time. He was just it was widespread, like where he was everywhere. He had such a politically connected dude.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's reliable. I mean, and that's the thing too. When we have to give credit to the organized crime families, especially in the early days, is one, they had to be organized, they had to be able to take care of their business, but they had to be reliable. You had to know for a fact. Is if things have X happen, Y would happen. I.e., if you didn't have
your leg,
your arm would be broken. But if you hit the numbers, you got paid. You know, you had people had to have the trust and knew that things were going to occur.
Yeah, well, look what happened to Buzzy, you know, as a perfect example. He was trusted to do a job, and it didn't do it, and that's what happens. It's amazing to me
that
out of that group, that original group of guys from back then, he's the only one who didn't make it. You know, Meyer, Lucky, Frank, and even Vito, even though he ended up in prison, you know, they all survived, which is amazing to me that anybody would survive that long through that life dealing with the situations that they dealt with. But they all did. I think that says something for the way they did their business, or, you know. But like, I hate I don't like to, like you say, to make them into the myths or to idolize them or, you know, fanboy kind of stuff, because, you know, they are what they were. They were gangsters, but they are interesting guys, and there's definitely things that
could
be learned from their lives.
Well, and again, something, I'm no sociology expert. I'm not. I'm some guy doing what I can do in my neighborhood to try to make things better. One of the big things I'll point to is some of the early history of the gangsters, because they were educated in their own way. They did have to every day show up for work. They couldn't take long vacations because they had too many things to take care of. But yeah, that Frank got up every day around the same time. He worked into the evenings when he had to make sure his business was taken care of.
Yeah, he always got up at, they say, 5:30, and he did his little walk and then went and did his business. He used to chew out underlings at one time. He's like, you know, said, do your business during the day. Don't do your business at night. There's nothing but trouble to be had by doing your business at night.
Yep.
You know, he wanted to be perceived as a businessman, as like CEO or something. And I think that's one of the reasons he got caught up in the Kefauver debacle. You know, he didn't see himself as really doing anything necessarily wrong. And he had dealt with these guys kind of above board for many years, and I think he thought he was going to get a pass, you know, he was mistaken. But, you know, those guys kind of felt like, well, we're part of this whole system. We've all been working together, you know, together for years, and now you're going to throw me to the wolves. He had a hard time seeing it that way. But,
the good senator who thought, you know, during those committee hearings was making him the next president kind of had a surprise coming, didn't he?
The whole thing is pretty hypocritical. You know, we know that now when you look back through history and you find out about people 20 years later and stuff, but it made for good spectacle, at least. It was a bad move on Frank's part, but, you know, from my point of view, we got a lot of great footage. There's audio of them talking. There's two stories, tons of pictures. For me, it's great.
I concur. It's great history. And that's what better to educate children, kids of all ages, than to show them the videos, show them the pictures, show it what it was like, you know, what it used to be like. You know, I'm shocked that Chicago has never taken it upon itself to go to some of the now rundown buildings that used to host the breweries of Capone and the like, fix them up, clean up a little bit. Make them into a museum. You know, you could charge admission up the Wing Wang, and people for miles would come along and see them.
We're not very good about that in our country, about saving those kind of things and preserving that kind of stuff, unfortunately, you know. But
if
you're a city like Chicago or Las Vegas, why not embrace it? You're already known for it anyway. And, you know, and there's people like me and you that are going to go. I've been to the Mob Museum three times, you know. I love it.
I have to
I'm a
go.
Member, so...
Okay, I'm going to have to go. I tell Christopher, whose last name I don't want to mispronounce. You know, the guy that did the Lucky Book.
Yeah,
I keep teasing him that we're going to go to Vegas, you know, and hopefully we don't spend all our money on hookers before we make it to the Batman Museum, but you never know.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, one of my trips, I met him there. He was speaking, talking about his Murder, Inc. book at the Mob Museum, so I went and watched his presentation and talked to him a little bit. It was great. It's very nice to meet
him. Yeah. I mean, one of the things, too, I want to thank you for this again, sir, is all the numbers of great people I have met doing this podcast. I mean, I don't have the best voice in the world. God knows I know that, right? I don't have the bells and whistles that many people have in their shows. But have people like you and Christopher and others come on this show has made my day, has really improved my life in all so many ways. I just want to thank you, not to say you have the air on, and other people who even listen to this, right? Thank everybody for doing so.
Well, I love it. I mean, any chance I get to talk to an actual real person about mob stuff instead of typing it on a computer, I'm there. You know, I've always, you know, in these chat groups and things, talking with folks, but you don't, it's hard to meet people who are actually interested in person, and at least my circle, so there's not that many people who can talk to about it. So
I'll do it any chance I
can get.
Well, I appreciate you coming on and the like. I appreciate you writing. But let's talk about more about you and the writing. You write for a column, right? Correct?
I do some stuff for the NationalCrimeSyndicate.com. It's not a regular thing. When I come up with an idea or if I have something, Craig Timmons, the guy who runs it, who's just been nothing but wonderful to me, he just lets me do whatever. He's never told me no. And so when I come up with something, I'll put it up there. And I also help out with the Classic Gangster Society Facebook page, not the commission chat group, but Gar O'Brien, the guy who runs the Facebook page. He's kind of the same way. He lets me just, you know, put what I want up there, and it lets me do my thing, which has been great. And kind of the same thing with you. I've met a lot of real interesting people through doing that. Right now what I'm trying to do, like I said, I'm beginning the very early stages. It's probably too early to even be talking about it, but of a book with Diamond Jim Moran's grandsons. And, you know, Diamond Jim was a very good friend and partner with Frank Costello. So these guys have been giving me just, you know, great stories, information, pictures that I've never seen. And I've seen most of them. You know, I spend all day looking at this stuff. So even, you know, I've been doing this now for about 2 years with Frank's place, and I'm still finding new stories, new pictures, new footage of him. I mean, there's just tons of stuff out there on the guy. So he's a good subject to follow if you're going to, you know, pick a guy to follow. Some of the later guys like Lombardo, you know, Vince Lombardo, were really successful bosses, but there's maybe one or two pictures out there and, you know, five stories, and that's it. They were so secretive. There's just nothing. There's no stories to tell yet. But, you know, Frank's got a lot. So he's a good subject.
I think that we, as a people, have an ornate interest in the mafia and organized crime. I know I was out spending a ton of money on some suits yesterday at Men's Warehouse, and I let an older couple, probably in their 80s, in front of me, right? Because why not, right?
Uh-huh.
I was busy talking up the female clerk, and I talked to this older gentleman back and forth, and he tells me about working for Pabst Brewery. He tells me about working for Pabst Brewery and what he used to do. He became a street guy that would go to the bars around town selling more Pabst, right? And then he talks to me about growing up with the Ballasturi family. It's like,
oh,
mother
wow.
of sweet Jesus. Now, he doesn't know I did the Milwaukee Mob, right? I'm just some guy in the clothes store with him talking about his interest in beer. Because to me, I'm fascinated with speakeasies, prohibition, how it affects the breweries. And like, that fascinates me, right? And he likes talking about this. So I spent a good hour of my afternoon talking to an older gentleman who was happier than hell, talking about what it was like back in the 30s, selling beer, growing up crazy in the city of Milwaukee.
So, yeah, you know, I love if I can find somebody like that these days that you can talk to. I had a similar experience one time when I was getting ready to go to Vegas a few days before. I just struck up a conversation with a custodian at a property and, you know, mentioned I was going to Vegas. And he's like, where are you going to stay? And at that time, I was going to be staying at the Flamingo. And most people are like, why would you stay at the Flamingo? You know, and my response is always, you know, if you have to ask, you wouldn't understand, you know. I've been there three times, and I've stayed at the El Cortez, the Tropicana, and the Flamingo.
Okay.
This guy goes, he's like, oh, you like the old Vegas. And I'm like, yeah, that's, you know, that's the Vegas that I'm interested in. I mean, we had an hour-long conversation after that. I know it's all about the mob and everything. So, yeah. People are definitely interested.
They are. And what gets me, and I want to turn you into the book since I have you on the phone, it's called Spooks by James... by Jim, I spell Hugan, H-O-U-G-A-N, and he talks about the change from the mob to Howard Hughes,
right?
How the corporations came in, and if we thought the mob was up to nasty shit, they got nothing on corporate America.
Oh, yeah. Costello actually met Howard Hughes once. He didn't think too much of the guy, from what I've been able to ascertain. I don't think they got along very well.
No,
it sounded like the first thing he wanted to do, he tried to borrow money from Frank Costello. The legend is, Hughes never had cash on him, and so he tried to borrow some money from Frank, and Frank was like, what is this all about? But those guys that took over, that kind of thing, it's the same thing. It's the mob. It's just a different name on it. Like you said, it's corporate. The corporation runs the same way. They're just as bloodthirsty and cold when it comes down to the dollar.
Yes, they do. And the musical question I ask is, how did Steve Wynn, of all people, get the rights to a little bit of a parking lot and was able to parlay into a small fortune? I don't think it was a random luck. But that's the way it is. So if people want to communicate you to talk about your great writing because you rock out or simply worship you as the mob star of the future, how do they get a hold of you?
The best way to get a hold of me is probably through the Facebook page, on Frank's Place, or you can get a hold of me through the nationalcrimesyndicate.com too. I have there's a contact button on that. I don't have it up in front of me right now, so I can't tell you exactly where it's at, but you can get a hold of me there too. And, hopefully this book thing will get rolling and within the next year or so that'll come out. But it's a good time, though, to be a Frank Costello enthusiast. There's a lot of good stuff coming out. Anthony DiStefano has a book coming out in 2018 that's going to be – I believe it's the first new book on Frank since about 1974 or 75. So – he's been talking to some great people, so I know he's going to have some really cool information. I'm really looking forward to that one. And Christian Ciccolini's got his next edition of the Lucky comic book is going to be coming out, and I think Frank is going to be in this next volume. So he'll be in comic book form, which is kind of cool, because Frank doesn't usually make it into movies or the pop culture stuff as much as the other guys, so it's interesting to see him there.
I want to thank our senator who ran those hearings for the one thing that he did, when they had Virginia Hill on the stand.
Oh, yeah.
I read that through and I thought, and I forget what my book I had, but I didn't quite believe it, and then I did some digging around that. Certainly, that story is definitely true. But, sir, I thank you. Sir?
Yeah.
Okay. I love her to death. I do thank you for coming on the show. I wish you the best of luck in your endeavors, and I hope as your book gets starting some type of a format that we can have you back on again.
Oh, you bet. Definitely.
All right, sir. With that, then you have the best of days, and remember, gamble safely.
Great. Thanks for having me, Wayne. I really appreciate it.
The pleasure is mine, and I want to thank you for listening. You can always find me easiest way is at the Milwaukee Mob on Twitter. All right. The little lady tells me I have to go. There's going to be hit out on my ass. So with that, everybody have a great day. We'll talk to you all soon. Bye.
Take care, Wayne.